log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
An unprecedented trove of leaked IRS data shows who reported the most income in America from 2013 to 2018, as well as their tax rates, revealing that the very richest pay lower rates than the merely rich. Stay with us for an article in this regard, published in ProPublica under the heading America's Top 15 Earners and What They Reveal About U.S. Tax System. Here's more. Thanks to an analysis of its unprecedented trove of IRS data, ProPublica is revealing the 15 people who reported the most U.S. income under taxes from 2013 to 2018, along with data for the rest of the top 400. The analysis also shows how much they paid in federal income taxes, and it demonstrates how the American tax system, which theoretically makes the highest earners pay the highest income tax rates, fails to do so for the people at the very top of the income pyramid. The top 400 earners pay noticeably lower tax rates than the merely rich. And if you include payroll taxes, a married couple making $200,000 a year could end up paying higher tax rates than a person making $200 million a year. Scan the names on the list of the top 15 income earners and you're certain to recognize several names, or at least the names of the companies they founded. Bill Gates hasn't been involved in the day-to-day operations of Microsoft for over a decade, yet he still earned the most during the years experts studied, reporting an average yearly income of $2.85 billion and an effective federal income tax rate of 18.4%. Steve Ballmer, his former colleague, is also a well-known public figure, both for his time as Microsoft CEO and his current ownership of the Los Angeles Clippers NBA team. Ballmer's average annual reported income of $1.5 billion landed him in the 10th spot on the list, and his effective federal income tax rate was 14.1%. The other side of the PC Mac Wars is represented by Lauren Powell Jobs, widow of Apple founder Steve Jobs. Her average reported income of $1.57 billion ranked fifth highest. She paid an effective tax rate of 14.8%. ProPublica sought comment from everyone mentioned in this article. Nobody disputed the numbers cited here. Unless otherwise noted, representatives for people named in this article either declined to comment on the record, or did not respond to requests for comment. Another well-known billionaire sits just below Gates on the list, media and tech mogul and former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg, with an average reported income of just over $2 billion, paid an effective income tax rate of 4.1%, by far the lowest rate among the top 15. The presence of Amazon founder Jeff Bezos, either the first or second wealthiest person in America, depending on the day, won't shock most people. But Bezos' annual reported income during these years of $832 million put him only at number 15. He paid an effective tax rate of 23.2%. As previously reported, Bezos had so little income in a couple of recent years that he was able to pay $0 in federal income taxes in those periods. Tech billionaires dominate the top 15, but hedge fund managers account for a full third of the names on this list, and some of their incomes were just as huge. Most of them paid relatively high effective tax rates, especially compared to most of the tech sector representatives. Hedge fund managers often make their money through short-term trades, which are taxed at a much higher rate than when tech titans cash in on long-term investments. The highest earning hedge funder is Ken Griffin, founder of Chicago-based firm Citadel. From 2013 to 2018, he reported an average income of nearly $1.7 billion, putting him fourth on the list. Griffin paid a tax rate of 29.2% during these years. Israel Englander, co-founder of Millennium Management, paid at a 30.8% rate, while the co-founders of two Sigma investments, David Siegel and John Overdeck, paid tax rates of 31.6% and 34.2% respectively. Some of this variation in rates reflects how people structure their businesses under tax law. Income earned by publicly traded corporations is taxed at the company level. When it's passed on to big shareholders, such as tech billionaires, it can come in the form of dividends, which are taxed at lower rates than ordinary income. By contrast, the income from some manufacturing companies and hedge funds flows directly to company owners, who pay taxes on it, resulting in higher effective tax rates on average. Lists of the world's wealthiest individuals are always heavily populated by heirs, ranging from descendants of old money to scions of more recently minted fortunes. Dozens of heirs made ProPublica's list of 400 biggest income earners. Descendants and relatives of Sam Walton, founder of Walmart, claim 11 spots. The DeVos family, heirs to the Amway fortune, also have multiple members in the top 400. Perhaps the best known is Betsy DeVos, who served as U.S. Secretary of Education during the Donald Trump administration. With a reported annual income of $112 million, Betsy DeVos was the 389th higher earner in this period. Much like the tech titans who topped the list, most of these heirs get their income from dividends or long-term investments, which are taxed at a low rate. Their effective tax rates ranged from as low as 10.6% for Betsy DeVos to a high of 23% paid by Walmart heir Tom Walton. Another key way that some top earners reduced their tax liability was to claim significant deductions, often in the form of large charitable contributions. This is particularly true for wealthy investors who are able to make their donations with shares of a stock. Thanks to a generous provision of tax code, they can then deduct the full value of the stock at its current price without having to first sell it and pay capital gains tax. Michael Bloomberg achieved a tax rate of 4.1% from 2013 to 2018 by taking annual deductions of more than $1 billion, mostly through charitable contributions. From 2013 to 2017, he also wrote off an average of $400 million each year from what he paid in state and local taxes. The 2018 tax overhaul limited that deduction to $10,000, but also introduced a huge new deduction for pass-through companies that Bloomberg benefited from. Midstream.
Events have been escalating in the occupied Palestinian territories for several weeks now. They began with a series of individual commando resistance operations carried out by Palestinian youths in different areas in Beersheba, Khdeira, and Tel Aviv, and caused a great shock and confusion in the Israeli security and military circles. This escalation was accompanied by political tremors in the structure of the Israeli coalition government led by Naftali Bennett after the withdrawal of the head of the Israeli Yamina party, Idit Silman, which makes the coalition on the verge of collapse at any moment. The gradually escalating Palestinian scene for weeks has taken on more interesting forms, with the increasing state of systematic Israeli incitement against Islamic sanctities, especially towards Al-Aqsa Mosque, and the Zionist settler group's announcement of their intention to slaughter sacrifices in the courtyards of Al-Aqsa Mosque in a move aimed at imposing a new reality in preparation for the demolition of the actual Al-Aqsa Mosque and the building of their alleged temple. The unity of the Palestinian resistance factions politically, militarily, and on the ground, with the threatening language they launched from the Gaza Strip, made the office of the Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett issue a statement denying the intention of the settler temple groups to slaughter sacrifices during the next 7 days of the so-called Jewish Passover. This explains the Israeli fear of a repetition of the scenario of the Sword of Al-Quds battle, whose memory still terrifies the Israeli occupation and its leadership, which suffered a catastrophic failure in the face of the resistance, its steadfastness and its courage in its fight to defend Al-Aqsa Mosque last year. The excessive brutality of the occupation's behavior towards what is happening in a state of massive revolution in all Palestinian areas reflects a state of hysteria, shock, and intense confusion among the occupation's authorities. In order to understand this confusion, it is necessary to understand a set of premises, as the state of confusion is not caused by an Israeli failure in the security and military tools in confronting the revolution of the Palestinian people. Rather, it indicates the erosion of the plans and the failure of the theories and policies that were applied to the Palestinians and which Israel bet on during several stages in the last few years. These are sequential stages, the first of which is the so-called Operation Defensive Shield carried out by the Israeli occupation forces in Jenin camp in 2002. Then the stage of the outbreak of the Al-Aqsa Intifada, and later the stage of the Palestinian division and the tightening of the iron security grip on the resistance in 2007. Ending up with the stage that we are witnessing today, which is considered the most important in all previous stages, as the city of Jenin is once again at the forefront of the resistance scene as a starting point for Palestinian military operations against the temporary Israeli occupation. Welcome to the Mideast Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Dozens of worshippers were injured on Friday morning as a result of the Israeli occupation forces attacking them inside Al-Aqsa Mosque after thousands of people performed the dawn prayer in the chapels and courtyards of the mosque. The Al-Quds Red Crescent said that it had dealt with more than 200 injuries, including injuries that varied between rubber, sound bombs, and violent beatings and other means of torture. Meanwhile, the popular and armed uprising continues throughout the occupied West Bank in support of Jenin and its camp in a scene that does not seem to be receding soon. In addition to the decline in the strength of a Palestinian Authority, the surprising development of the capabilities of the resistance fighters in Jenin and the resistance of the jihad movement to defend and protect the families of the resistance fighters, the occupation authorities anticipate the possibility of a dangerous escalation in the Gaza Strip as well. To discuss these issues with us from the West Bank is Mr. Mohammed Shradat, political researcher, commentator, and writer. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Mohammed. Now, the occupation forces assaulted women, elderly, journalists, and guards of the Al-Aqsa Mosque and broke the upper glass of the Al-Qibli prayer hall to shoot the worshippers. Do they ever learn? Do Israelis not realize that with such violence, they are just leading to more resistance?
This Zionist occupier is part of a historical system from the old ages. They do not learn because of their arrogance, their conviction that they are God's chosen people. Unfortunately, this stereotype in the Zionist mind, which was expressed by the Zionist movement with the creation of this usurping entity, is translated every day with brutality against the Palestinian people. Today, they appear on us by breaking waves and breaking inspiration. This Zionist mentality that invaded Al-Aqsa was arrested, beaten, shot, and broke the historical glass in the Qibli prayer hall in Al-Aqsa Mosque. This is a plan by Naftali Bennett, Gantz, and Lapid, a plan that they started preparing before Ramadan, at the beginning of Sha'ban. They went to Washington and said that there is an escalation coming in Ramadan. Some thought they meant a Palestinian escalation. Yes, there is a permanent Palestinian escalation, and it's part of the state of confrontation, favoritism, and self-defense. But these people have a plan now, which is to bring about a change in the rules of the status quo in Al-Aqsa Mosque. This settler Bennett, an ideological settler, wants to give a gift to the far-right settlers. He wants to tell them, I have presented to you what Netanyahu was unable to do and what Sharon, Rabin, and Begin failed to do. He wants to say that we have contacted the King of Jordan, the Palestinian Authority, and Egypt, and he will allow us to hold the blessings of our Easter blessing. In order for the settlers to occupy the roofs of the blessed Al-Aqsa Mosque for a period of 7 days, and then contacts will be established with Gaza and Ramallah. And no one is moving a finger, unfortunately, in facing this temporal and spatial change, as happened previously in the Ibrahimi Mosque, in order to allocate a place for the worshipping Zionists alongside the Muslim worshippers. And if this is tolerated at this stage, the future will be even greater, with the complete Judaization of the West Bank, unfortunately.
Well, Mr. Muhammad, thousands of Palestinians from the occupied 1948 territories and the people of Al-Quds have flocked the Al-Aqsa Mosque since the early dawn hours every day in during Ramadan to perform prayers in response to the calls of popular and religious groups to protect the mosque in light of what you just presented and described about the temple groups, quote unquote, who want to storm the mosque and bring about or perform slaughter offerings inside of it. It seems things will only escalate. How do you think will it look inside the interior 1948 territories if it were to spread in there too?
There are many changes happening with our 1948 territories in Umm al-Fahm and Nazareth and in Haifa. Yesterday, they raised in Haifa the banner, "This monster is an illusion of dust," a statement which was launched by Gilboa hero Mahmoud al-Arda. In Nazareth, they demonstrated the day before yesterday in huge numbers. In Umm al-Fahm, there is a permanent sentimental presence of Al-Aqsa Mosque. There are whole nights spent by our praying people who come from all the seats of the Palestinians inside our occupied lands in 1948. And whoever is prevented from entering protects Al-Aqsa Mosque, just as happening yesterday when entire buses from Umm al-Fahm were prevented from entering the Aqsa Mosque and they chased after the settlers outside the wall of Al-Aqsa Mosque. The land of the 1948 were in full support during the Battle of Saif al-Quds, and today you find them guarding this mosque. It's not possible for all the regional and local powers, whether in Ramallah, Gaza, Amman, Cairo, or the axis of resistance, to rely solely on these Palestinians of the interior. These people, in the early morning of today, closed the doors of Al-Aqsa Mosque on themselves and launched a violent confrontation with the occupation to protect the mosque from the settlers, and most importantly, to protect the mosque from the occupation policemen who stormed the mosque by the hundreds in order to protect a handful of settlers. These policemen are the most dangerous because they enter the mosque heavily armed and pull a barrage of hatred and anger on the Palestinian worshippers.
Well,
Mr. Muhammad, the Islamic Jihad movement in Palestine affirmed that the Israeli occupation's attacks on worshippers in Al-Aqsa Mosque are an aggressive crime for which the occupation bears full responsibility as well as for its repercussions. Now, are we going to see another missile escalation or this time the focus might shift only on internal lone wolf operations, which proved, by the way, to be very effective during the past month?
Jenin did what it has been doing since Sha'ban until Ramadan, and it has been in a state of confrontation for decades, especially in the past 2 years. A year and a half ago in Jenin, the occupation vehicles received nothing but permanent confrontation with all their might through these young men scattered in the alleys of the camp. But the brothers and the leadership of the resistance in Gaza, perhaps a political stance is required of them to cut off contacts with the Egyptian side and not to receive communications that turned out to have no function but to pass on the temporal and spatial changes that occur in Al-Aqsa Mosque. The summit of evil that was held at the tomb of Ben-Gurion 2 weeks ago, in which Egypt participated along with other normalizing Arab states, led by the Zionist entity. The summit was meant to pass this change in Al-Aqsa Mosque. Therefore, what is required of the leadership of the resistance now is to search for options other than option of communications. There is always a third way. Today, for example, 10 vehicles of Zionist army entered Beit Hanun near Gaza. My point is, there are always ways to exhaust the occupier which he fears. The occupier wants reality to be either a truce or war. Yes, Gaza may have been thickened by wars, but what is happening now since Sheikh Jarrah and the battle of the Sword of Al-Quds, and the great difference that the Sword of Al-Quds made in the situation inside Al-Quds, this difference is now intended to be blown away through silence, acceptance, and habituation. The habit of seeing settlers enter for 7 days during these alleged Zionist holidays in order to desecrate Al-Aqsa Mosque, while the police attack the worshippers, subject them to beatings, arrests, and impose exorbitant fines on them. Therefore, we ask the brothers and the resistance to make a political difference in their position, and then to stand firm and persist in its consequences, because staying in this current form lead to the Judaization of the West Bank and the elimination of the Palestinian cause by pushing the approach of normalization countries that global to the occupation. For example, Erdogan thanked the Palestinian Authority because, in his opinion, it dealt wisely with the current developments in Al-Aqsa Mosque. What wisdom is Erdogan praising for suppressing hundreds of worshippers and inserting in their place a handful of Zionist settlers?
Well, it seems, Mr. Muhammad, it seems that we are looking upon several weeks of escalation if the violence from the Israeli entity continues against the Palestinian people. I want to thank you very much, Mr. Muhammad Shahradat, political commentator, researcher, and writer, for joining us to talk about the latest wave of violence from the Israeli entity against the people of Al-Quds and the people of Jenin as well. Thank you very much for being with us. Now, please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about the upcoming parliamentary elections in Lebanon.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Well, despite the approaching date of the parliamentary elections in Lebanon scheduled for next May 15, doubt is what fills the air in Lebanon until the expected date, in light of historical experiences in which political forces cancelled previous merits under the pretext of security threats or regional and international external factors. The ruling elite is obsessed with the possibility of changing the parliamentary structure, and the pro-American forces are concerned and afraid of losing the race towards the parliamentary majority. All the while, this election session is witnessing a historically unprecedented boycott of the Future movement headed by Saad al-Hariri, a boycott that affected the plans of his Saudi-imposed political allies. Skepticism in Lebanon in this following report.
Lebanon is preparing to hold parliamentary elections on May 15 amid a severe economic collapse that the country has been enduring for 2 years and the possibility of the country sliding into further deterioration in the coming months. Despite the extent of the economic, social, and livelihood collapse that Lebanon is experiencing, and the elections will also be the first since a nationwide popular uprising in late 2019 that sought to change the status quo of the government, it also comes after the explosion of Beirut port in August 2020, which killed more than 200 people and flattened several neighborhoods in the heart of the capital. Since then, the crisis has hit every home in Lebanon, with the collapse of the national currency against the dollar, the collapse of purchasing power, the rise in food prices, and even driving to work has become a burden for the Lebanese due to the soaring fuel prices. However, nowadays the trending talk in Lebanon is the parliamentary elections. This seems normal after the country has practically entered the month of merit, and thus the countdown to Elections Day has begun. Yet, what does not seem normal in the midst of all the preparations is the waves of skepticism whether or not the elections will take place on time. This skepticism, in which technical factors overlap, linked to electricity outages and strikes by university professors and judges, and political factors overlap, linked to the lack of enthusiasm and fear of results, which forced the President of the Republic, Michel Aoun, and the Prime Minister, Najib Mikati, to emphasize once again in the last cabinet session that the elections will take place on time and the necessary funds have been approved. A new scenario is being extensively reported about in the Lebanese media, claiming that Western diplomats are now openly talking about the possibility of no elections. Some even sought to promote that international community no longer wants the elections to take place after opinion polls showed big progress for the pro-resistance team, which, as per the opinion of many, called for a Persian Gulf breakthrough, leading to the hustling return of the Saudi and Emirati ambassadors to Lebanon last week in an attempt to adjust the balance of power with the minimum available means. Apart from the debate of whether or not the parliamentary elections will be held on time, the electoral process has become more intense in most electoral districts, and this has been evident in recent days through the high level of rhetoric and the exchange of accusations between various contenders. However, all of the above, according to what those concerned say, cannot be a fundamental reason that justifies postponing the elections or cancelling them, as the elections have become a fait accompli that can only be overridden in the event of a major external incident, a possibility that seems remote for the time being.
To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Jamal Wakim, political commentator, author, and academic. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Wakim. Now, the question mostly asked at this time in Lebanon is, will the parliamentary elections be held on time next month, or will they be postponed, or worse, even cancelled?
Good evening. I believe that there are a lot of possibilities. There is a possibility that the pro-American team or coalition in Lebanon might work to postpone the elections because they think that they will not earn the majority in the parliament, that Hezbollah and their allies will be able to have the majority. And this will spoil the American plan to impose a majority that will take random decisions, arbitrary decisions at the expense of Hezbollah and its allies. And that's why I believe that this team and the United States will work on obstructing or creating a situation where the elections might be postponed.
But I was following on your analysis of the situation, Dr. Wakim, in Lebanon, especially lately on social media in the past week, where you anticipated that not only the elections won't take place, but you also said that Lebanon might plunge into another civil war that will completely destroy it this time. Where is your pessimistic view, if I may, coming from?
Well, it comes from the intention of the United States to project the embroilment in Ukraine onto Iraq and Lebanon, because the United States was planning since a long time to transform Ukraine into a bleeding site for Russia, and at the same time transform Lebanon into a bleeding site for Syria, and Iraq a bleeding site for Iran. So, based on this hypothesis, I concluded that the United States might either work to earn the majority, or for its allies to earn the majority in the Lebanese parliament. This way they will form, a one-sided government that will take arbitrary decisions against Hezbollah, and their logic will be, we have the majority, so let the majority rule and the minority be in the opposition. Of course, if this happens, or if the elections are postponed, then the parliament will lose legitimacy, the current parliament. There will be no presidential elections, and all powers will be concentrated in the hands of the Najib Miqati government, which is pro-West and supported by the West. So in this case, Najib Miqati will take these arbitrary decisions. In the beginning, Hezbollah and its allies will try to absorb the situation, the tension, but they will be pushed And Najib Miqati will keep pushing them until they react, and this reaction will project itself onto the street, clashes in the streets between the various parties.
But all of what you're saying is based on the opposition, on the pro-American side winning a majority in the parliament. What if they lose?
If they it's based on them winning the majority or canceling the elections. Mm-hmm. Okay, if the elections happen, then most probably Hezbollah and its allies will earn the majority. But still, if they earn the majority, they will be prevented from ruling. The Americans and their allies will revert to collateral plans or to contingency plans, so that they would be able to absorb the situation. And this, in case Hezbollah wins the majority, then we will see demonstrations in the streets after the economic situation gets aggravated. So if Hezbollah wins the majority, then we will see a further deterioration of the economic situation, increase in the exchange rate of the U.S. dollars, people further suffering economically, starving, and then going into the street and blaming Hezbollah and its allies for not being able to resolve this situation. This is the American plan in all three cases. In mm-hmm. case the elections happen and the pro-Americans win the majority, in case it gets canceled, and in case Hezbollah wins the majority.
But the people can see clearly who was behind the policies that brought Lebanon into this crisis, but we have Western-funded and backed NGOs along with Western-backed political factions that seem to be thrifty now when it comes to campaigning. They're throwing their money left and right. Yeah. Meanwhile, the working class is banned from withdrawing their savings and sometimes their own salaries, like what happened to me last month when I tried to withdraw my salary and they wouldn't allow me at the bank. Yeah. They said it's been too long since you withdrawn, and it was just late 10 days since I withdrawn. How long do you think it will take for a real uprising against the ruling 1% to hit Lebanon?
Well, too bad. I believe that the pro-American team is using all it could in order to divert the clashes or the confrontation from being between poor and rich to being between a segment of the population and Hezbollah, and of course between the people themselves. So that's why I fear that we might face a situation where we have a civil war.
Well, that seems a bit scary, to be honest with you, Dr. Jamal, but this is what the case has been in Lebanon ever since the ruling class finished off with their civil war and entered with a disastrous financial situation in Lebanon. I hope for the best, and I hope for the best for you as well. I want to thank you very much for your contribution and for joining us to talk about what might happen next with the upcoming elections in Lebanon. And thank you. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Mideast Stream.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
The Zionist regime is doubling down on its apartheid rule over Palestinians while it and its international accomplices attempt to fend off the label. Please stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Maureen Claire Murphy, journalist. This article is titled, Zionist Regime Doubles Down on Apartheid. Here's more on this issue. The Zionist regime is doubling down on its apartheid rule over Palestinians, while it and its international accomplices attempt to fend off the label. Recently, the Zionist regime reinstated a ban on Palestinian family unification as part of its demographic engineering efforts to ensure a Jewish majority in the territory of historic Palestine. Adala, a group that advocates for the rights of Palestinians in the occupied territories, said that the legislation is one of the most racist and discriminatory laws in the world and must immediately be repealed. The Citizenship and Entry into Israel order prohibits the Zionist regime's interior minister from granting residency or citizenship to Palestinians from the West Bank and Gaza who marry citizens of the occupied territories. According to Adala, which will challenge the law at the Zionist regime's high court, it also bans unification between a citizen or resident of Palestinian territories with spouses from Syria, Lebanon, Iraq. Adala added that UN human rights bodies have called on the Zionist regime to revoke the ban on Palestinian family unification as it violates the international law. The Zionist regime's parliament, the Knesset, has renewed the temporary order banning family unification 21 times over the past 18 years, the rights group added. However, unlike in the past, the current version of the law explicitly states that its purpose is to ensure a Jewish demographic majority, Adala added. The Zionist regime lawmakers and Ayelet Shaked, the regime's interior minister, has said the legislation is intended to prevent Palestinians from gradually returning to their homeland. Demographic engineering is also informing the Zionist regime's policy on refugees fleeing the violence. Recently, Shaked said that the influx of mostly non-Jewish Ukrainians fleeing to the occupied territories cannot go on. Shaked added, anyone with a brain understand that we can't continue at this rate of entry. The Zionist regime's obsession with demographics is nothing new. It has prevented millions of Palestinian refugees and their descendants from exercising the right to return to lands from which they were forcibly displaced on the basis that they are not Jewish. Shaked acknowledged the apartheid nature of the family unification law by tweeting that its approval was a victory for a Jewish and demographic regime and a loss for a regime of all its citizens. The Zionist regime's law, passed in 2018, stipulates that the right to exercise self-determination in Israel is unique to the Jewish people. Stateless Palestinians living in the West Bank and Gaza face similar restrictions, with the Zionist regime refusing to confer residency status to foreign nationals who are married to Palestinians living in those territories. Jewish settlers face no such restrictions. Amnesty International highlights the Zionist regime's denial of nationality, residence, and family life in its recent report, finding that the Zionist regime practices apartheid against Palestinians. The suspension of family unification procedures in the West Bank and Gaza affects tens of thousands of foreign nationals married to Palestinians. Meanwhile, the Zionist regime prohibits Palestinians in Gaza from residing in the West Bank. The human rights group Al-Haq has stated that Palestinians are forced to make life choices as personal as who they marry and where they live based on the constraints of the Zionist regime policies and practices that not only target them but are ultimately aimed at their transfer. Since its inception, the Zionist regime has prevented Palestinians from living in their homeland through the mass expulsions and displacements in 1948 and 1967 and permanently cancelling the residency status of Palestinians in the West Bank, including Al-Quds. As a result of those efforts, hundreds of thousands of Palestinians who were born in Palestine are now considered foreigners with no immediate right of entry or stay by the Zionist regime, according to Al-Haq. The Zionist regime also prevents Palestinians living under military occupation from exercising freedom of movement, imposing arbitrary travel bans on more than 10,500 Palestinians in the West Bank last year. The Tel Aviv Daily Haaretz reported recently that the Zionist regime will vet any foreign lecturers wishing to teach at Palestinian universities in the West Bank. Universities will be able to employ lecturers from abroad only if they teach in fields that have been designated as essential by the Zionist regime. The prospective lecturers must hold a doctorate and will have to submit applications for such permits at the Zionist regime consulate in the applicant's country of origin. COGAT, the bureaucratic arm of the Zionist regime's military occupation, will ultimately approve any entry of a lecturer. That body exercises control over the movement of people and goods in and out of Gaza, including medical patients seeking care, not available in the besieged territory, whose life-saving treatment is frequently denied or delayed. From September 2020 to March 2021, the Zionist regime denied or delayed the travel applications of one-third of all Gaza patients seeking medical treatment in the occupied territories and the West Bank. Applicants seeking to teach at Palestinian universities will have to prove to the Zionist regime's satisfaction that they will make a significant contribution to academic education, to the regional economy, or to the promotion of regional cooperation and peace. The Zionist regime defies virtually anyone who criticizes it or advocates for Palestinian rights to be against peace. This means that the Zionist regime will in effect be imposing total political control over Palestinian universities. According to Haaretz, the number of lecturers will be limited by a quota to be determined by Israel, which currently stands at 100. Meanwhile, only 150 foreign students will be allowed to study at Palestinian universities per year, and COGAT will determine the fields of study open to them. The new restrictions, expected to be implemented in May, have spurred renewed calls for the boycott of Israeli academic institutions, many of which have deep ties to the Zionist regime, occupation, apartheid, and settler colonization in Palestine.
8-year defense of Iranian combatants.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
It's a double celebration in Iran, only days apart for the army and Sepah. So let's have a word on those forces today. The classical approach to realistic international relations defines power in terms of military capabilities. Traditionally, this concept places a high value on states' reliance primarily on military force for maintaining their independence. Iran, like any other player in the chaotic international system, strives to maximize its military power in order to preserve its survival. For this purpose, and to offset the problems imposed by the arms embargo since 1979, the country has embarked on different methods, including developing asymmetrical defense capability and relying on its allies to preserve its status as a major military player in West Asia. The Iranian military consists of two major institutions, regular forces or the army, called Artesh, and the Islamic Revolution Guard Corps, IRGC, called Sepah. These two operate separately but are coordinated. The Artesh is based on classical doctrine and operates as a traditional military organization, while Sepah is based on revolutionary doctrine and operates by asymmetric warfare. Now, with an imposing extra-regional military presence in the Persian Gulf and West Asia, Sepah or IRGC has gained increasing power in Iran over past decades. For a closer look, stay with me, Leila Faramarzi, on Iran Today. Army Day is celebrated annually on April the 18th. It was established by the father and first leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khomeini, in 1979. 2 months after the fall of the deposed Shah or King, he met with Iranian Armed Forces soldiers who made an invaluable contribution to the victory of the revolution. A few days later, Ayatollah Khomeini named April the 18th as Army Day, calling for military parades to exhibit the nation's military preparedness. After the victory of the revolution, the army got scattered, according to one of our wartime gems. But then come the 1980 eight-year imposed war with Iraq, the country's safety and sovereignty was not abandoned. Brigadier General Ovesi may be retired from his service and flying fighter planes in war, but he's still today departing his knowledge as university professor.
The Americans left the country expecting that we would not be able to fly the F-5s, but we managed to fly them. Then the war started. We managed to confront the enemy's attacks by those F-5s. Moreover, let me tell you about the F-14 aircrafts. It's interesting to note that the F-14s had computer systems installed back in the 1960s when no one even knew what computers were. It was considered to be very high-tech at the time. Much to our enemy's consternation, we flew the aircraft and defended the nation.
Iran's Revolution Guard Corps, also known as the Sepah, was also established in April 1979 by Ayatollah Khomeini as a paramilitary organization charged with protecting the newborn Islamic Republic. In time of war or facing foreign threats, however, the two military arms join hands. Mr. Haji Najjar, a Sepah Sardar or general, tells how that worked during the Iraq-Iran war.
Following Saddam's attack on Iran in September 1980, the morning after the Iraqi warplanes conducted their attacks, 140 Iranian fighter jets bombarded various targets inside Iraq. This showcased the efforts made in the first couple of years since the victory of the Islamic Revolution for the reconstruction and maintenance of the army. As you might know, following the victory of the Islamic Revolution, almost all army commanders of the former Shah regime either fled the country or were retired. Many of them had committed treason and were tried and executed. We brought in a new generation of the army.
Today, Sepah has evolved into one of the most powerful political, ideological, military, and economic players in the country. It has been entrusted with a diverse set of indoctrination apparatus, training programs, and system welfare provisions intended to broaden support for the state. Annually, the government makes a show of military force with parades on Iran Army Day, often demonstrating new defense technologies. Army veterans, active servicemen, and reservists take part in the parades, which are ceremoniously held before the mausoleum of Imam Khomeini. After masterminding a counteroffensive which led to the retaking of the port of Khorramshahr in May 1982, a turning point in the Iraq-Iran war which went on from 1980 to 88, Artesh of the army helped to recover all areas lost to Iraq for the rest of the war. The credit here basically goes to the Air Force. Since the end of the mentioned war, the assigned role of the Artesh has not changed much. It has been led to remain apolitical and confine itself to its mission within the military doctrine of the Islamic Republic. There must be a difference between the Artesh of today and the Artesh pre-revolution, however.
After the coup of 1953, Americans extended their control on Iran, including the country's army. They organized the army according to their policies and strategies. American military advisors, whose number had reached 40,000, a few months before the victory of the Islamic Revolution, had total control of the Iranian army.
Today, commanders at large are post-1979 trained officers who in military colleges received indoctrination in Islamic beliefs and allegiance to the principle of velayat-e-faqih, that's the governance of the jurisprudence. Mr. Obeisi contradicts the generalization. He was trained before the revolution but rose in the ranks after.
My trainer was American. He'd admit that his Iranian counterparts are better than him. He acknowledged that and actually believed it too. When I'd use the term our F-5s, he'd protest, telling me that it wasn't ours. We merely paid for them. The F-5s were called easy maintenance aircraft. When the Americans were leaving, I remember the trainer telling me that we couldn't make such an easy maintenance aircraft operational. He predicted that they'd return in a couple of months. That was what he said verbatim.
The Artesh has four services, the ground forces, the navy, the air force, and the air defense force. Though it has its own command and control and joint staff, coordination between Iran's military forces, consisting of the IRGC, Ministry of Defense, and Police Command, too, is assigned to the general staff of the armed forces of the Islamic Republic of Iran. These general staff headquarters were set up in 1988, and its commanders are appointed directly by the leader, as decreed by the constitution. The overall doctrine of the armed forces, the Artesh and IRGC, is heavily influenced by lessons of the Iraq-Iran war and shifting perceptions of threats against this country. What it's based on is deterring a technologically superior adversary, like the United States. In the context of this doctrine, the ground forces of the Artesh, with some 350,000 men, 220,000 of them being conscripts, are to form the first line of defense against invading forces. In contrast, the IRGC's army, with a strength of some 150,000, together with the omnipresent Basij resistance force, is to establish the second line of defense and act as a stay-behind force in case of foreign aggression. When asked about how Artesh today compared to itself in its pre-revolution form, Commander Obeisi preferred to make a much more amusingly unexpected comparison. He compared its functioning to the US, the manufacturer of its fighter planes.
The Phoenix missile is an advanced air-to-air missile. We didn't have enough of it to use during the war. Our engineers and technicians managed to install surface-to-air Hawk missiles on F-14s. This was another first in the world. No one had tried doing that